The way Leggett, Ottawa is a small Canadian FBI office. They have them all around the world. And I'm going to go on a limb and guess they are not for situations like this. This talk from the FBI about business addresses, they refer to Raphael and his phone a few times this way, as a business. To me, this signifies that they viewed what he was doing as being like way more sophisticated than it actually was. I don't think they understood that he was a kid on a couch. If you read through these FBI files, it tells a story, one where they sized Raphael up and progressively became more and more convinced of his legitimacy. They became convinced that he had the titanium briefcases and that someone, maybe Tamika Woods, maybe someone else, had authorized him to open up Ruthless Records in Canada. This phone hacking technique Raphael figured out when he was in elementary school, it had outsmarted the FBI. Back at the apartment, the calls kept coming in from Jerry Heller with the FBI on the line and Tamika Woods.
So she actually called me, Tamika Woods. And she said, who the hell authorized you to open up? And she was yelling. And I said, I didn't know what to say. I'm 19 years old. I'm like, Jerry Heller. He hung up the phone pissed. She was not a happy person. You know what I mean? She hung up mad. You know, like, what's going on? I'm just pitting both people that are already in a court battle against each other.
Just to recap here, when Tamika Woods would call and ask who told them to open up in Canada, Raphael would say it was Jerry Heller. Then when Jerry Heller would call, he would say it was Tamika. And they weren't talking to each other outside of court. So Raphael was one of the few sources of information they had. They took the bait and got even angrier at each other. Meanwhile, these calls from Jerry and Tamika, as good as Raphael was at handling them, he just found them annoying.
My whole thing was basically to deflect these guys. Like, I just wanted to keep answering the phone and getting money from the people that I was getting money from. These guys were actually a burden to me, calling me, like Tamika or Jerry Heller, because I didn't even want to talk to any of these motherfuckers. I wanted to continue just grabbing money from people. That's where we were making money.
By the way, Tamika Woods did not respond to her interview request for the story. Anyways, the phone kept ringing.
But it went on for like 4 months. You know what I mean? 3 months or something like that. It went on for a while. I don't remember exactly how long, but it felt like forever, you know?
Until one day.
All the calls stopped. And then at like 2 a.m. when I called Ruthless Records number, it was back to the regular machine.
At this point, what happened was the judge had sorted out who was going to run Ruthless Records. It was handed over to Eazy-E's widow, Tamika Woods. So under Tamika's care, the doors to the building opened back up, and it looks like the first thing they did was change back the voicemail message.
It was like, it's all over. You know what I mean? It was like a good ride, but yeah, you know, the roller coaster eventually stops. You got to get off.
So the phone stopped ringing. That was it for Raphael. But you might be wondering what happened with the FBI's investigation. Well, you can see it's around this time when other issues started to pop up for the agency. For example, there was a question about whether Eazy-E's death was suspicious. Threats he was apparently getting up until the time of his death, and not long after, the murder of Tupac Shakur. Simply put, the FBI had way bigger fish to fry. So there's actually a page in the FBI file that explains this pretty concretely. Near the end of that summer, FBI agent Charlie Parsons contacted the district attorney, and it says he was advised by the DA that the FBI would not pursue the matter of the missing briefcases or the alleged stolen record company to Canada any further. In writing, the DA declined to prosecute. Raphael didn't know this until way later in life, until he found the FBI files online. But at this point, he was off the hook.
No, nobody got arrested. Nothing bad happened. So I was kind of happy about all that. Like, you know, there was no repercussion from it.
Thirty years later, it's probably safe to say he got away with it, which is totally nuts, right? Raphael had absolutely no idea the FBI was ever even looking at him. Years later, not until 2015, actually, Raphael was poking around on the internet one night, and he found the FBI file.
Dude, it was tingles. I was like, I had my hair on my arm was standing up because it's talking about me. It's talking about a time that I buried. And it's word for word bringing me back to like this convo with Jerry Heller, which is really f***ing cool, man, because now I really understand who Jerry Heller is. When I was talking to Jerry Heller, I thought I was talking to Jerry Heller. That was it. I didn't think the phones were tapped and everything. And you know how close we came to getting probably the door kicked out by RCMP? So yeah, it was surreal reading it. It was like, wow, the FBI was on me, right on top of us, like watching everything we're doing. We would have been arrested. We'd have been probably in the newspapers, you know, high school students rip off Ruthless Records. Imagine that, like the Ottawa Sun or something. I would have framed that page, you know, that would have been like my trophy, my little award, like a Pulitzer Prize.
But Raphael did actually save some souvenirs from this time.
Tapes of like from Kendrick Lamar, like Little Kenny, we'd call him. Singing, rapping, pictures, letters from different various people, maybe thousands of different people. I remember putting all his stuff with all the rest of the people's stuff in this box that I had in my room in the closet, my mom's. All the pictures, all the different audio tapes of people's stuff.
Every now and then, he would visit his childhood home and check out the storage bins, sort of reminisce a bit. That was until one day when the boxes were gone.
It eventually got thrown out when I moved out and I left everything in my old room closet. My mom, I guess, the old Lebanese woman. This lady had a holster with two Dustbusters, you know, and she was one of those like OCD cleanup people. So all my stuff got thrown out. It sucked. That stuff is probably worth money now, you know, like how much would that be worth? Young Kenny, freaking, I never knew he was going to blow up like that. I had no idea, like this kid's going to be somebody, you know what I mean? All that went into the garbage.
It's disappointing that all this stuff is gone. It really is. But in a way, it seems kind of right. The Raphael now, he's such a different guy. He's evolved, he's matured. And he looks back on this chapter for what it was. Like, it was brazen, it was cool. But ultimately, it's something he feels bad about.
It felt like a bag of shit, bro, because I like being in that position of, like, power. Yeah, you really, like, I don't know, it's stupid as hell, but like, you really felt like you were some executive of this record company. You know what I mean? Because we were playing that character for, like, months, you know what I mean? So, and it was cool as hell, like, just having all these people calling you, like, all these different rappers and singers and really cool time. The older me apologizes. It was a different time. Consequences weren't so, I got family with kids and, you know, my life's different now, right? So I'm not that 18-year-old, not even a shadow of them, you know?
And what I find most remarkable is just how many things in the story could have gone so wrong for him, but they went right every time. He got off scot-free, and I don't think he would have in any other universe.
I bounced off Jerry Heller. I bounced off Tamika Woods. I answered LA Times reporters. I talked to people that were owed money. There was nothing that was getting in my way of getting money from these guys. It was an unbelievable feeling. It was just like you felt powerful. That's the best way to describe it. Nothing could touch me at the time. I was bulletproof.
That's your Canada Land. I hope you enjoyed it. You can email me about what you heard at jesse@canadaland.com. Today's episode was written and reported by Julian Abraham, who first learned about this story in a Substack post by Ben Westhoff. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Caleb Thompson. Today's episode was fact-checked by Max Collins, who is also Canada Land's director of audio. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So Called. Our additional music today was produced by Julian Abraham. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
I'm Sam Graywall, and today we're talking about the news. We'll talk about dropping the developers and building the housing we need. We'll talk about what's on the reading list over at Build Canada. But mostly, we'll be talking about wildfires, heat waves, and droughts. Back in the headlines for another summer. But is it time to waterbomb the way we cover climate?
We're trying to tell you that the entire planet is about to be destroyed.
Okay.
Well, it's, just something we do around here. We just keep the bad news light.
Right. It helps the medicine go down.
Wait for that. Welcome back to the show, Global Managing Editor of DSmog and author of The Petroleum Papers, investigative climate journalist Jeff Dembicki.
Hey, good to be here on the show.
Let's talk about these wildfires across the country.
225 wildfires currently burning across Canada.
69 active wildfires burning across BC.
71 wildfires burning across Alberta.
Flames have leveled homes and buildings across parts of Saskatchewan.
Several northern Manitoba communities are being forced to evacuate once again.
The raging wildfires in northwestern Ontario have now reached a critical point.
A rough start to what's shaping up to be a long, hard wildfire. Fire season.
Jeff, it's no mystery what season it is, wildfire season. And I don't want to downplay or make light of the devastation caused by these fires and what it's doing to Canadians and communities across the country. But I do want to challenge the coverage by the media and the more broadly problematic mainstream climate change journalism in this country. You know, there's certainly a need for communities directly impacted by wildfires to be informed and updated. But for the general population, much of Canada's legacy media coverage, in my opinion, it's become routine and frankly pretty lazy to the point of sounding like background noise quite often. Do we report properly on these issues, Jeff?
I think media across the country do a pretty decent job of reporting on disasters when they happen. They interview the people who are evacuating, they provide information to the communities, and you get a sense of how these wildfires are playing out in very real human terms.
Jessica Barkman's family has been cooped up in hotel rooms in Winnipeg since leaving Cross Lake 3 weeks ago.
My oldest one, 5 years old, she thought we were all going to burn and we're terrified of the smoke.
And adjusting to the city and the traffic have been difficult.
You can definitely get that tuning into Canadian media coverage of the wildfires. But where I think the media here falls down a bit is by providing the context we need to understand why these wildfires are happening. And I think that's been lacking forever in this country.
Yeah, I want to give a little bit of background. Climate coverage is definitely on the rise, but research by RE.Climate, a nonpartisan public institution housed at Carleton University's Sustainable Energy Research Center, it analyzed 12,000 stories published in the Globe and Mail, on Global News, CTV, The National Post, a bunch of other big outlets in the first 6 months of 2023. Climate change was rising up in the agenda during that period in 2023. After decline in 2022, the media coverage in terms of sheer numbers of stories definitely increased in 2023. Some journalism organizations even began to feature climate change in the environment as a standalone section, like its own standalone part of their outlets in terms of a real focus, a real priority for their media platform. But then move over to the Globe and Mail, one of our technically two mainstream national newspapers along with the National Post. And here's the Globe's menu bar. It's got Canada, world, business, investing, personal finance, opinion, politics, sports, life, arts, drive, and real estate. What I don't understand, Jeff, is why wouldn't the Globe recognize that climate change, the environment, it's sort of organically part of almost everything we cover now. And I'm not talking about publications and platforms that specialize in the environment on climate change, like, you know, great outlets, the National Observer, the Narwhal. I'll even toot my own horn, The Pointer, the outlet I own. We have a designated environment section with a designated environment reporter, a journalist, Anushka Yadav. But when you take a look at our media ecosystem, Are you surprised that we're still here in 2025?
Yeah, it seems like there's been like little progress or evolution in how we talk about climate change. When I was at the Paris Climate Talks, Premier Christy Clark did a speech saying how natural gas was a climate solution, and other political leaders, I won't name them, in the room, they were saying that they were embarrassed by that because they thought it was so factually inaccurate. And yet, 10 years later, we're still repeating the same talking points, having the same debates. I think it's great when there's a wildfire and then an outlet like CBC or Canadian Press or Global will come along, and after a lot of the acute crisis has died down, they'll interview a climate scientist who says, yes, this is consistent with all the science we've seen. This is definitely caused by climate change. But very rarely will a media report in this country take one very necessary step further and explain to readers why this climate change is happening and link it to the fact that maybe it's due in part to Canada being the fourth largest oil and gas exporter on the entire planet.
Yeah, referring to that report that I mentioned earlier by Re.Climate or RE.Climate out of Carleton University, they talk a lot about how even with the number of stories on climate change, more broadly, various environmental issues, which is obviously incredibly spread out, and there's a diverse range of environmental stories, but when they are done by the Canadian media, the analysis showed that they're not very contextual. We get a lot of very inch deep, mile wide, it's hot out there.
Scorching, sweaty, and punishingly humid.
There is a heat dome sitting right over Ontario and Quebec.
Blistering heat and humidity.
Not only sizzling temperatures there, Care, but it's affecting weather really right across the country.
It's feeling like up to 45 during the day and little relief at night.
For the general public, when the coverage doesn't go beyond, I went to the Toronto Star website during the heat wave about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, and seven stories at the top of the website on the Toronto Star with some variation of like, hey, it's really hot or it's going to be really hot, and some good reporting about cooling centers and where to go and all that. But more broadly, what do you think?
So I think definitely there's a problem of Canadians getting media coverage that doesn't present the extreme weather situations we're facing in the right context at all. And that RE climate report you mentioned has a really interesting statistic in there. And it found after analyzing a whole bunch of media coverage across Canada that media mentions of climate change or extreme weather that also include a mention of fossil fuels, that was just 11% of all stories a couple years ago. And that percentage has actually decreased over time at the same time that all of this extreme weather and disasters we've been experiencing has gone up. And I think that's not really serving people across the country, because in order to make sense of why the weather is so wonky and crazy and uncomfortable and dangerous, we need to know that these changes to the global climate are being caused by the business models of a relatively small number of oil and gas companies, most of them based in Canada. And without that additional context, it just seems like there's all of this weird, random stuff happening. And I also think that creates a vacuum that a lot of people can fill with competing, extreme explanations for why things are happening. So I think it's no coincidence that in recent years, we've seen a real uptick in people blaming arsonists for wildfires. And that was something that was even given a platform by the Premier of Alberta.
I think we have to make sure that people understand that human activity causes the vast majority of our wildfires. Most wildfires are caused by human behavior.
And those claims are pretty easily debunked, but I think they speak to a lot of Canadians like really having a desire to understand why these changes are taking place. And media is not doing a good enough job at the moment giving that context.
Jeff, on this show, we like to duly note stories that we feel may have been overlooked. Do you have something that you'd like to duly note?
I would like to duly note a piece of an interview that McLean's magazine did with Daniel DeBow. And he is one of the main spokespeople and proponents of an initiative called Build Canada. It was pretty prominent this spring during the election, and it included tech executives and oil and gas investors, basically calling for the elimination of red tape and the construction of big nation-building projects. Pretty similar, actually, to what Carney is implementing right now in Bill C-5. And there's one piece of this McLean's interview that really jumped out at me, and it's the final question of the interview, where the interviewer asked Daniel DeBow what he's reading at the moment. And he mentions a guy named Matt Ridley. And most readers of McLean's might not know, but Matt Ridley is an advisor to the Global Warming Policy Foundation, which is one of the most hardcore climate denial groups in the Western world these days. And Matt Ridley was also a major political proponent of the Brexit campaign. And so I think in the context of all of this building Canada, eliminating red tape, it's pretty interesting that one of the biggest proponents of all of that is citing Matt Ridley as someone he's inspired by and who he's reading. I'll just leave it at that.
Duly noted. I would like to duly note a story. It's a Vancouver Sun piece, but it actually speaks to a broader issue, and it's actually very encouraging. The Vancouver Sun piece highlights a new proposal by city staff to greenlight a project that in two East Vancouver neighborhoods would dramatically increase the population by 60% in these two East Vancouver neighborhoods, so an additional almost 20,000 residents. And the type of housing is exactly what younger generations need, right? Transit-oriented, right next to transit hubs, and the type of specific housing model that we now know is what has been missing through a lot of research and a lot that's been reported in the last few years. And I see this trend finally across other cities in Canada, where councils, even provincial governments, are starting to say, yeah, we're not going to follow the lead of developers and the development industry who've made like terrible sprawl developments or hyper vertical condos that are either like too expensive for young people or they're not even what they're looking for. It seems, I just want to duly note that finally we seem to be shifting to the public taking back housing from the private sector, determining how it should be built, where it should be built, how affordable it needs to be. And I just want to duly note that.
Duly noted.
That's our show for today. Thanks for joining me. Jeff, so great to have you. You can find me at san.graywall at thepointer.com. That's san.graewal at thepointer.com. I read everything you send. Jeff, where can people find you?
They can find my writing on DSmog, as well as the amazing investigative reporting that the whole DSmog team is doing. And they can also find us on Blue Sky and whatever other social platform they like to use.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson. The associate producer is Lucy Lomonier, who also did the fact-checking. Mixing and mastering by Tristan Capacchione. Our director of audio is Max Collins. The editor and publisher of Canadaland is Jesse Brown. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Thank you.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. Why do so many species of birds choose the northern Great Plains to raise their young? Like the lark bunting, Sprague's pipit, the chestnut-colored longspur, or Baird's sparrow. After months of frigid cold and snow, warm spring days spur vigorous plant growth across the prairies of Montana, the Dakotas, and southern Canada. These grassland habitats are flush with insects that birds capture easily from the fresh grasses and wildflowers. The open plains are ideal breeding areas for grouse and shorebirds whose active offspring must forage for themselves while their parents guard them, like these upland sandpipers. Migratory birds connect the northern Great Plains with many parts of the Western Hemisphere. Sprague's pipit and chestnut-colored longspurs, for example, winter in central Mexico. And those upland sandpipers fly thousands of miles to the pampas of Argentina and Uruguay. Disrupting any part of a bird's annual life cycle, at their breeding habitats, migration stopover sites, or wintering grounds, reduces the survival of the species. We can help these migratory marvels thrive by conserving the rich grasslands they depend on to survive. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.